Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, October 24th, 2024. This is our second of three oral arguments. This is case number A24-0685, Clean Care LLC versus Jacobson Environmental PLC. We're delighted to have all of you here at Mitchell Hanlon College of Law for these oral arguments. We will be having 15 minutes for appellant, and will either party be splitting time? I see two. Okay, just want to confirm on that. So 15 minutes for appellant, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and 5 minutes for appellant for rebuttal, if you so choose. We have a clock to the side here. I cannot see the clock. So if you see my colleague to the left here, Judge Larson, looking over, she's not ignoring you. She's just keeping track of time for the panel here. I just want to let you know that when you begin your oral arguments, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Brock Alton. With me today is Brenda Sorrow. We are counsel for appellant Clean Care LLC. We're here today to ask the court to overturn the decision of the district court dismissing our case as against respondent in this matter. I'm going to refer to respondent jointly as Jacobson. It's a company and then an individual working within that company. There's two distinct but related issues before the court. The district court dismissed both a third-party contract claim and then also a set of three different tort claims. And the reasoning is different but similar on each. With respect to the third-party tort claim, the court found that a disclaimer in a letter of engagement that my clients had never seen prevented them from asserting that claim as intent to benefit beneficiaries, third-party beneficiaries, excuse me. And then as to the tort claims, lumped them all together and determined because there was a limitation clause in a report produced by respondent, none of those claims could proceed either because in her reasoning, my clients had no reasonable reliance upon the information in that report. So I'm going to take those in turn, starting with the third-party beneficiary claim. So it's important to remember, I think, as we go through this, that all of these questions are established as questions of fact, and that this case is decided on summary judgment. And we've cited a lot of cases of what the standards are for third-party benefit. The talisman shown for all of them is, to whom is performance being rendered under this contract? So the specific question before this court is, could a reasonable juror find that the performance was being rendered to Clean Care? And I think the answer is yes. This is a case where we're talking about whether or not environmental contamination may exist at a property. My client and his potential lender, CCCU, who is not here with us today because that claim is going to arbitration instead, they needed to know whether or not this building, which had been used in the past for dry cleaning services, may have been contaminated and retained through Servion respondent to make a determination in that regard. This is important, as testified by my clients. If we had to go beyond phase one into a phase two report, which is expensive, they would not purchase this property. In the first instance, respondent goes in and determines on a phase one, the portion that they were retained to do at that time, no phase two is required. Some time passed between my clients first purchasing the property with cash they received from, frankly, their parents, to trying to refinance with CCCU. And on the second go-round,
they had already purchased the property.
They had already purchased the property, correct. On the second go-round, respondent changes his opinion and says, yes, we must proceed to phase two. Well, at that point, as noted, my client had already purchased this property. So in the first instance, when respondent is going out there to determine whether or not contamination may exist such that a phase two is required, to whom are those services being rendered? The contract is literally with Servion, and all they are is a go-between party. CCU goes to Servion, Servion goes to Jacobson. They enter into this letter of engagement that contains the limitation clause. However, the services being provided would, of course, be most important to my clients, are purchasing.
Well, the fact that they're important, I'm not sure how relevant that is in the sense that they're not a party to the contract, right?
They are not. That is why it's a third-party claim.
And there's a very clear disclaimer that this is only for the benefit of the party requesting the services, not for any other party. And there's also language in there that says any other person who happens to rely on this, and they knew that your client could potentially rely on it. They have explicit language saying anybody who relies on it, they're doing that at their own risk.
Your Honor, there are two clauses in two separate documents. One is the letter of engagement and one is the actual report itself. The second part concerning reliance, that comes in the report. As to the contract that formed the basis, that has the disclaimer language, that's in a letter of engagement. I do agree that it's important that respondent indeed knew that my clients might rely upon his determinations, and then he attempts to limit that in his report. But that limitation, which goes to the tort claims, frankly, is not impactful. And neither is the disclaimer under established Minnesota law, including cases that this court has decided. The most important of which is, there's two Twin City cases, so I don't want to give you the wrong one. Twin City Construction of Fargo versus ITT Industries Credit Company, that's 358 Northwest 2nd, 716. That case is factually different from this case. It involves a construction project started by Bridge Street Partnership. They were going to build, I believe it was a Holiday Inn. They retained a contractor to build it. And at some point during the process, stopped paying that contractor. So they then enter into a loan agreement with the ultimate defendant in the case, ITT Industrial Credit Company. ITT's loan agreement is specifically for the purpose of paying that construction company. But the construction company, much like us, is not a party to the contract. It includes disclaimer language, just like we have disclaimer language here. Now, in the facts of that case, which, you know, the court under or below says those are dissimilar to our facts, that's true. They're not exactly aligned. But under the facts of that case, because the services being rendered were being rendered to the construction company, specifically a loan to pay them, the court ignored the disclaimer language, looked at the contract as a whole, which, by the way, the cases say the court must repeatedly, and under the circumstances of the case, taking the facts of the case into account and reading the contract as a whole, says, we're not going to find that this disclaimer prevents third-party beneficiary status in this contractor.
Is this case distinguishable from Twin Cities Fargo? Because I mean, at least in my reading of the agreement, the original agreement between Servian and Jacobson, I think the purpose of it is for CCC to know what kind of financing they would be willing to offer your client. It's not necessarily for giving your client advice about whether to purchase the property. Whereas I do think that in the construction context, right, there's sort of this direct line of where this money is flowing. Does the fact that there is sort of a separate purpose potentially for this contract change the analysis for the whether we overlook the disclaimer language or not?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I'll tell you why. First of all, there's nothing in third-party case law, third-party contract case law, that says there can be only one third-party beneficiary. I think it is probably correct to classify CCCU as one third-party beneficiary. They don't want to issue a loan on a property that doesn't have the value to support that loan, right? They, in fact, have not issued a loan in this case following the second report. My clients remain on the hook alone. But, and this is why it's important to look at other cases, including Toronto, the fact that it has that purpose doesn't remove us from third-party beneficiary law. So the Pronto case, it's also a construction matter. The town of White Bear agreed to assist the developer in developing property. They're going to do that by having roads built, sewer services, some of the items that go into developing this portion of the project, the city takes on, and then Pronto agrees to pay some special assessments so that that is performed. Like in Twin City, then the city goes out and gets a contractor to do that work and the contractor fails. Nothing in that contract mentions the developer. There's just blank. Nevertheless, and this, of course, the city has obligations of its own, and the contractor is trying to take care of those obligations and contracted with the city to do that. Nevertheless, because the services are being rendered on property that Peranto was developing, they are held to be a third-party beneficiary under that contract, and the contractor failed to do its job for numerous reasons that don't really matter here today. That contractor was therefore required to recompense them for their failures.
But again, I mean, isn't that, didn't both the city and the developer have the same purpose for using the services of the construction worker?
Yes, as do CCU and my clients.
Well, they as I understand it, your clients are wanting to use the report to determine whether or not they should purchase the property, whereas the bank, the credit union, is using it to decide whether or not they'd be willing to finance, what of their different options would be available for using their services to purchase the property if that was the decision, right? Do you see what I'm trying to say? I think that there's a little bit difference in purpose between how your clients were intending to use the report and how the credit union was intending to use the report.
There's a difference in the ultimate goal of the two different parties. That is true. But the purpose of the report and how they're using it is the same. Does this property have potential contamination such that it has to go to phase two? If the answer to that is yes, CCCU has one determination. Okay, we're not going to send out a loan. Our clients have a separate one, true. Okay, we're not going to buy the property, but their interest in the services is actually exactly the same. Do we have to go to phase two? Is there a risk of contamination or not? It's important to both parties. I would stipulate that it's more important even to mine, who now actually own this place. And we don't even, you know, it's not part of this record, let me put it that way. The total amount that they will be out is up in the air. A phase two could lead to a phase three. I mean, a lot of these companies that own these properties end up going bankrupt.
And this may be, since you're running out of time and I do want to get to the tort claims, I guess part of my question is if this isn't a third party beneficiary contract claim, if there's not an intent to benefit, it maybe is part of the reason the law is developed that way, specifically because we have tort negligence claims for professional. I mean, I was, I guess, surprised when I was looking through the case law to see that we haven't actually had any case law in this context of the purchasing of property with banks or credit unions. And I wonder if part of that is that some of this third party beneficiary case law has been in the tort context of professional negligence. And I guess I'd be interested in how you see those two claims potentially interacting with each other.
I see them both as relevant and necessary claims for my client to bring. Ultimately, you have to go to a jury and show that jury something else for each claim. Already discussed, you know, the services rendered showing we must make in terms of the third party beneficiary. As to the common law claims, and this is important, what you must show varies. On two of them, you must show that my client was in the position that they could foreseeably be harmed if services were rendered negligently.
And is that under the duty element?
It is under the duty element. That's right. It describes the scope of a duty for a professional in the state of Minnesota.
So do you interpret the district court's order as deciding as to all three claims purely the duty element? Is that how you would interpret the district court's order?
Essentially, yes. But unfortunately, if you look at what the district court decided, she doesn't discuss the foreseeability element at all. Instead, she goes to the element that matters for a negligent misrepresentation claim, which is reasonable reliance. And she looks at the limitation language and says, well, given the limitation language, that's not reasonable. I'll get to that in a second. I don't believe that is.
But all of this is under the duty. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding that in terms of the common law claims, all that has been decided by the district court is that Jacobson does not have a duty under each of the three claims and hasn't moved on to the other elements.
As to negligence and breach of fiduciary duty, yes.
Okay.
As to negligent misrepresentation, her determination is that there's no reasonable reliance.
No reliance. Okay.
That's right. So they argued duty in their briefing, but since they knew that our client would use this information, I think our case law is pretty strong on duty. Her determination was about reasonable reliance. I just want to note, and we're down to a minute and a half already, in their briefing, they also don't get into foreseeability. Nobody, district court or respondents, has come up with any good argument why it wouldn't be foreseeable that rendering these services negligently could harm the purchaser of the property. And by the way, that foreseeability element isn't limited to parties that you know their name and who they are and that are paying for your report. If an engineer designed a building and the building was poorly designed and it fell over and crushed the building next to it, they would have liability to the building next to there, the owner of that building, because their poorly designed building crushed the neighboring building. It wouldn't matter if they had any relationship with that party. It's foreseeable that the neighboring property could be harmed.
Or whether the contract or report itself said no one else can rely on this contract.
That's
because
right.
You can't contract out of your own negligence.
There is no case in this state, and I haven't seen one from any other state being cited, that says you can prescribe common law tort duties by putting something in a contract to which the party harmed is not even a party.
Counsel, I have a more basic question. I realize we're running out of time, but why didn't your client directly retain Jacobson or another party for that matter to do the report? Because your argument seems to be very strong on reliance on that report. Why didn't your client just hire Jacobson or another party to do that examination?
I think that there's a practical response to that, which how do these transactions happen? You're dealing with a bank. The bank lends money. The bank needs these reports. The bank does this every day. They know that Servion exists. Servion knows how to go out and find people. And people in the position of my client don't have all of that information. And if I may, time's up, but I'll just add quickly to that. The district court did say, well, hey, you could have went out and got your own person. And that's true. We could have. But that doesn't excuse this respondent from doing their job and doing it well, or otherwise remove us from being able to make claims against him when we are harmed when he doesn't do that job well.
But you certainly would have a much stronger claim if you had hired and you were a party to a contract with a company that did that examination, correct?
I don't think that the claim would be any stronger. I think it'd be a different claim, breach of contract. But the tort claims and the third-party beneficiary claims in this case, in my opinion, are quite strong.
Well, breach of contract claim certainly is a pretty strong claim if the company that you hired did not do the job properly, correct?
It's also a pretty strong claim to say that the company negligently performed their work and thereby harmed us. I do not believe it would be a stronger claim. It would just be a different one.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Patrick Kelly. I'm here with Attorney Richard Saucedo from my law firm. We are here representing Wayne Jacobson and Jacobson Environmental in this case. We are asking you to affirm Judge Sullivan's summary judgment in this case. My plan is to discuss, again, both sides of the case, whether appellant could qualify as a third-party beneficiary to the contract between Mr. Jacobson and Servion, and then discuss the tort claims as well. Wayne Jacobson was hired to perform an environmental site assessment for the credit union so that the credit union, as Judge Larson alluded to, could determine whether it was reasonable for it to make a loan based on that security. They wanted to investigate the quality of the security. If it were an environmental hazard, they would be more reticent to make the loan. That's why he was hired. That's what he did. In our materials, we refer to the Twin City Federal Bank versus Zimmerman at 411 Northwestern 2nd, 294. This is a case that is very similar to the one at the bar. In that case, the homeowner got a loan from TCF, and as part of that loan package, they paid for mortgage insurance for TCF, protecting TCF in the event of a default. Of course, the plaintiff in that case did default, but then they wanted the benefit of that mortgage insurance. They said, well, we paid for it. We should be a third-party beneficiary because we need it now. We paid for it, and that's part of our deal. the clear language of the insurance policy at issue and the contract said, no, this is not for the homeowner. The homeowner, as you may know, has its opportunity to purchase its own mortgage insurance, and it can do so and be protected. In this case, they did not do so. This is very similar to the case here. The plaintiff, appellant here, sophisticated real estate investors, had the opportunity to seek out their own ESA. They had to get one for the credit union so the credit union could determine the sufficiency of the security for which they were accepting the mortgage. But the appellants did not. So I think if you read this Zimmerman case, you'll find that it's very similar to the one at hand, and I think it should control.
The way I understand appellant's argument, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, is that this contract is different because it's clear from the contract who the intended purchaser of the property was, that your client actually met with one of the potential purchasers as part of preparing this report, that it was very clear to your client that it was not just the bank who would be using this report as part of preparing it. And so this should fit into the line of cases that I don't think you disagree exist, that say you can overlook the contracting parties saying there won't be third party beneficiaries when it's very obvious to the two parties who are contracting that there's a third party beneficiary and that they're the one who's intended to benefit. And I wonder what your response is to those particular facts in this case as to why this shouldn't be a fact issue that goes to the jury with regard to what the intent of the parties was with respect to this contract.
Sure. I think, Judge, at the tail end there, you hit on an important fact that there must be shown an intent to benefit, not just in the contract, but from everything else. So the only contact that Mr. Jacobson had with the appellant here is that one of its owners was present for the walkthrough inspection that was performed.
And their name appears in the contract, correct? I mean, Jacobson is on notice that there are potential purchasers, and that's the reason why this assessment is being performed.
Jacobson is on notice that there are potential purchasers, yes, but that doesn't put him on notice that they're going to rely on the report when he specifically told Servion and the credit union that they should not let people rely on it. And the report itself says don't rely on it. So
I thought the testimony, and you can correct me, I thought that there was some testimony that those provisions appear in the contract because they took this contract from somewhere else. And there definitely are some facts in the record that would indicate there wasn't a lot of consideration over the inclusion of this clause in this particular contract, that this was sort of a standard form that they took from somewhere else.
It's a clause that Mr. Jacobson uses on all of his contracts and all of his reports, specifically because he knows that, yeah, sometimes people will try to save a few bucks and not get their own report. The reason for that is if, let's say this was a different case, that the bank did give a loan on it. It was determined to be an environmental hazard and the purchaser defaults. In that case, the damages would be basically what the bank loaned. So it's a specific discrete amount. If Mr. Jacobson didn't include that language, then the damages could be the cost of cleanup, which could, dramatically exceed that. So that's why he has that limitation.
But I mean, isn't it, and maybe this moves into the tort claims, and I do want to make sure that we reach the tort claims. Part of this is that the purchasers, and maybe take it out of this context, just maybe in a, not a sophisticated buyer, but first time purchasers of a business, are already paying once to get one of these environmental reports, and maybe the, you know, the finances don't work for them to buy two reports and they already have one. Why, you know, why isn't it foreseeable to your client that that there may be reliance on this report to make a decision about whether to purchase the property?
Well, as Judge Sullivan noted in her order, the specific, and let's consider it a warning, do not rely on this report, or if you do, it's at your risk.
Well, and that might matter for the negligent misrepresentation claim, yes. But I do have particular concern with the conflation of a general common law negligence claim and the claim of negligent misrepresentation, because I do think that the what you need to show in order to get to a jury on the claim with regard to duty is different between a negligent misrepresentation claim and a general common law negligence claim, which I do think appellant is right, requires a showing of foreseeability. And in, you know, in the general common law context, you know, we have principles about how you can't put into a report waiving your own negligence for somebody relying on it in the context of a general negligence claim. And so why isn't there a problem with the district court's order in that it's conflated three very different torts into negligent misrepresentation when you look at the complaint and there are three separate claims?
The three separate claims each require a duty. And
but I mean, you don't disagree that the duties are different between a negligent misrepresentation claim, a breach of fiduciary duty claim, and a general negligence claim, or else we would just have one tort.
Right. And some of this goes back to the second part of the third party beneficiary claim, that, you know, there's the intent to benefit versus the duty owed test.
That's contract law. Now we're in common law tort.
Right. But we're discussing duties in the context of a contract, and a lot of those principles apply. So if there's not a duty in regard to the third party beneficiary claim, that's going to move over, and you're going to use those same factors to analyze whether there's a duty.
I mean, it's that you're not a party to the contract, right? The third party claim is that you're not a party to the contract, and the parties who did enter into the contract did not intend for you to benefit from the contract is a different inquiry than whether as a professional engineer, you have a duty when preparing your report to do it to a certain standard with respect to people who are going to foreseeably rely on that report. And that foreseeable reliance is a different standard than whether or not you are a party to the contract. Those are two different legal standards.
That's correct, Judge.
And I guess I'm troubled by the fact that in your briefing, you don't actually address the general common law negligence claim and the foreseeability issue. And so it would be helpful to me to know your response to appellant's argument that based on the record that we have here, summary judgment is inappropriate because there is evidence that their clients would foreseeably rely on this particular report in deciding whether or not to purchase the property.
I think to answer that question, Judge, we did cite two cases. One is Safeco versus Dane Bosworth. The citation escapes me. I apologize. The other is the non-presidential case, La Perea versus Jones Lang LaSalle. Both of those cases stand for the proposition that foreseeable reliance doesn't exist in the commercial context when you have sophisticated parties on different sides of a transaction.
But isn't that a negligent misrepresentation claim, not a general common law duty claim?
I think it applies to each of the negligence claims in this case, Judge. If you look at La Perea, they clearly were relying on information given by the owner's agent. And in that case, the court said, look, you're a professional. You're responsible for handling your case, your own side of the transaction, you need to satisfy yourself of that. And in this case, the appellant has not done that.
So is your argument that negligent misrepresentation and general common law negligence are the same tort? Sorry, I'm looking at the clock because I'm also keeping time for the panel. I apologize.
That's okay. I apologize, Judge. Can you ask that question again?
I guess my question is, do you disagree that negligent misrepresentation and general negligence are two different torts? Because, I mean, even when I look at your briefing, your argument goes specifically to negligent misrepresentation as opposed to a general common law negligence tort. And the way I'm understanding your argument is that when you have a negligent misrepresentation claim, perhaps you don't have a negligence claim, that those two are subsumed within each other.
I will say you can't have any negligence without there being a duty from one person to another. And in this case, the duty owed by Mr. Jacobson is specifically to the foreseeable users of his product. Mostly that's going to be the bank, because that is the purpose. And I think you discussed that earlier in response to appellant's statements. That was the purpose of the report. The purpose of the report as to appellant is not going to be apparent to Mr. Jacobson.
I just want to be clear, the La Perea case, that's a negligent misrepresentation case, correct?
I believe it is, Judge.
Okay. Are any of the cases that you cite ones that apply, that found that there was no duty or foreseeability under a negligence claim, an ordinary negligence claim, not a negligent misrepresentation claim?
The Safeco versus Dane Bosworth is a claim where Dane Bosworth didn't investigate properly. So I don't think that would be considered a negligent misrepresentation claim. That's where Dane Bosworth was investigating an underlying investment to help Safeco determine whether to write bonds on it. And in that case, I don't think it was a representation. It was negligence.
So Safeco was negligence.
Yes.
And that case also was a summary judgment case as well, correct?
I think so.
Okay.
I see my time is up. I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, for response, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I first want to respond on a couple of occasions now in the briefing and then here today. My clients have been referred to as a sophisticated commercial party. One of the two investors in Clean Care had some background in purchasing properties. Neither of them had any experience with environmental assessment reports. The sophisticated party here is on the other side of the table, the gentleman who testified he'd done it 200 times, and who offers an opinion in his report that the property should be sold at fair market value. I can't imagine someone in those circumstances couldn't possibly foresee that a buyer would use that information. I certainly think that's a question that should be put to a jury. I wanted to talk a little bit about your last question because...
Any evidence in the record that explains... So this particular report that Jacobson was asked to prepare was in the phase one EAS. Is that report, does it look different when it's secured by a financing entity as opposed to secured by the purchaser of property?
I do not know the answer to that, and I don't think that that's part
it's
of
not
this
in the record.
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks.
My apologies. Your last questions were directed at negligent misrepresentation, and I didn't have a chance to speak to that. First, I do want to say Safeco is a negligent misrepresentation case, and it's the first case in this state, I believe, that discusses this arm's length transaction principle and upholds it. I have to say that principle is entirely inapplicable here. We're not talking about a case where these two parties came in as adversaries and negotiated a contract. That's kind of the whole point. They weren't in a contract together. So this, that line of cases, Safeco, LaPar, all of it has nothing to do with the circumstances of this case.
Well, their interests are not aligned. I mean, in many ways, they're diametrically opposed because one's a purchaser, potential purchaser, and one's a potential financer.
But the cases are about representations made during negotiations of contracts. It's Safeco, for instance, you had a lender coming in and reviewing a bunch of documents. They did their own background search that then received representations from the client looking for a loan on the other side or the potential client. They were both represented by counsel. This is a negotiated agreement they're coming to. That's what these cases are about. It's not about a circumstance like this where one party commissions something, actually didn't even commission it. The bank for a party commissions a report. We're not in a contract together. We're not sitting across the table from each other. We aren't making representations to him and coming to an agreement. He's not making representations in us and coming to an agreement as between these parties. The line of cases simply doesn't apply at all. Also, it wasn't part of the district court's underlying determination for what it's worth. I do want to say the district court relied upon a case. It's Dakota Bank versus Island. That case, again, only goes to negligent misrepresentation. The case has a clause somewhat similar to this one. And because of that clause, but also other facts, the court holds that indeed reliance wasn't reasonable in that case. But it involves accountants taking information and compiling it, handing it over. And then the disclaimer says, we didn't verify any of this. We just took what they told us and put it in a format you can read. The court says, well, if you're receiving that information and they're telling you, we haven't verified the underlying facts at all, it turns out this corporation is underwater, you know, but that's being hidden by the corporation. All the accountants do is compile the information and hand it over. Okay, that's one thing. It distinguishes itself from an earlier case, Bonhiever. And I think that this is important. It's also an accounting case. But in Bonhiever, the outside accountant actually prepared the books for the company and offered opinions to a regulatory agency coming in and taking a look at those books to determine whether or not an insurance company was solvent. It's a very long case, and most of it is not applicable to this matter. But as to the third-party beneficiary, or excuse me, as to the negligent misrepresentation part of that case, the court looks at it and says, once you go past just compiling information, you do the work to put these books together, and you offer the opinion that they're accurate, you're in a different bucket, and they can bring a negligent misrepresentation case against you. So even there, which is the only finding on common law claims that the district court made, really, it's just on the negligent misrepresentation case. She read one case and not the other, but the one more applicable here is Bonhiever, because Jacobson explicitly offers opinions throughout his report. He's not just compiling information and passively handing it off. I've cited a bunch of instances in my brief.
May I ask one question, since there's 15 seconds left? How do you respond to the district court's reliance on Walter Pump or the position that Jacobson did not have a duty to your client?
Was that in the negligence? I'm sorry, I don't.
It's in the negligence section. She says that the case that she found most germane your client cited was the Walter Pump case because it involved economic loss in the context of commercial activity. And she found that the case was distinguishable for a number of reasons. And if you're not
I am prepared, Your Honor. I think that the distinguishing factors that she found in that case are not actually important. And I would note it's a case that allows a negligent misrepresentation claim to go forward.
So Walter Pump is also a negligent misrepresentation claim.
And just talk about foreseeability.
I guess I can't say that offhand, Your Honor. I'm not positive, but I did look at the case and the facts. She did this on a few occasions and said, your case isn't exactly like that one. That might be true, but you have to go back to the fundamental principles that guide the court in deciding cases, which is the standards and rules of law that the court has. And under those standards and rules, we have a valid claim.
Thank you, counsel. Looks like we have no further questions. We appreciate both of you in terms of your arguments and your briefing, which is very thorough and very well done. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you all.